On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Behind all the urgent headlines from Lebanon and Iraq and the great heat wave of 2006, a deep fuse keeps burning under America's future. It's the federal deficit and American debt. It is huge and on course to get much, much bigger. So big that it could one day paralyze this country and wreck the lives of our children and grandchildren. But spending under President Bush has rocketed. Special interests grab subsidies and tax cuts. Politicians shout we're too polarized to act. But are we really? A new movement in deliberative democracy says that when ordinary Americans sit down and talk, the deficit can be licked, the chasm can be closed. Up next on Point, citizens deliberate the deficit challenge. We will hear in this hour from Americans who've been part of an experiment in deliberative democracy this summer, from its organizers and backers, and from you. We're joined first by Heidi Gantworth in San Diego. She's vice president of Viewpoint Learning, an organization founded by the public opinion research firm of Daniel Yankelovich. Heidi, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
And with us from Washington, Robert Bixby, executive director of the Concord Coalition, a nonprofit group that describes itself as nonpartisan, devoted to informing the public about fiscal responsibility. Robert Bixby, thank you for joining us.
Hi, how are you?
We're great, and it's wonderful to have both of you. We're looking forward to hearing more voices as well. But Heidi, explain to us the experiment that you're in the midst of here. What's going on and why?
Well, we are putting together a project that is looking at how the public faces up to the nation's finances. And the question that we're trying to ask is, how can Americans, and these are regular Americans, think about the fundamental choices that we have to make about the future that we want for our country, the future we want for our children. And the debt and the deficit are part of that. But really what the debt and the deficit mean are, you know, they have a lot to do with the kind of choices that we can make. What kind of programs can we fund? How do we want to treat the elderly? What investments do we want to make in our future? So we are part of a project involving the Concord Coalition, the Heritage Foundation, the Brookings Institute, and the Public Agenda, working together to talk to Americans around the country about these issues and asking them to think through a set of choices for how we can deal with these issues.
So you've got backers and partners of different political stripes there, sort of liberal, conservative, and maybe in between. And the first big issue you put on the table is the deficit. And you've just done this, in three cities around the country, San Diego, Kansas City, Philadelphia. How did you assemble whom, and what kind of results did you come out of these conversations with?
Right. We went to three cities, and this is really the starting point for what we hope will be a much larger project. Mm-hmm. And we brought together about 40 citizens in each of these cities, and they are randomly selected to be representative of that population. So we look at the population data, and so the group looks like the population of that region. We don't know anything about the people when they come in the room other than, just sort of the barest information. And we put to them the question, what kind of America do you want 20, 30 years from now? And we talked to them a little bit. We gave them some background on where our federal dollars go now. What are the things that we stress in federal government? And we asked them how might they change that? And it's really a values conversation. We're not asking regular citizens to be experts, to turn into technical experts. We're saying technical experts have an incredibly important contribution to make. But the other important contribution has to come from citizens, because any kind of real sustainable change has to have citizen support.
And fascinatingly, what you found was not them dividing into two camps, throwing rocks at each other, but something very different. But before we come to that, Robert Bixby, lay out for us, if you would, the problem, the challenge that gets put before these citizen groups from across the political spectrum, the deficit challenge that the country is facing. What is it?
Well, what they are given is a brief overview of the fiscal future, which is pretty problematic when you start having the baby boomers qualify for Social Security and Medicare. Almost everyone who looks at this concludes that fiscal policy is just simply unsustainable. The deficits and debt would grow to such levels that it would choke the economy. Now, we're talking about something in the 2030s or so, but it's a problem that begins now, and the best way to address it is to start now. So what we do is give them some basic background information, not too detailed, but just enough so that they get the basic picture, which people seem to pick up on right away. And they have different ways that they can deal with it. They're given four different scenarios of how they would like to deal with that, whether they would like to deal with it by cutting back on some of the promises that we've made to for Social Security and Medicare
in the
future, or whether we want to raise taxes to pay for that rather than cutting back, or whether we'd like to cut back on some of the promises for Social Security and Medicare but invest the money in other things like education or the environment or defense or something. And then another option is to just sit back and essentially do nothing and hope that economic growth or something will happen to bail us out. So they're sort of given a series of value choices. They're not really necessarily sitting there with green eye shades.
Right. And a calculator.
I do that. But
but that's not what citizens do. We're going to hear from some of the participants in these meetings. You report, Heidi, that the one thing that doesn't happen are these American groups talking together, deciding to do nothing. We're going to look at the kind of at the way that they tended to lean, the kind of consensus that did and did not emerge. But before we do that, Heidi, remind us, in your executive summary of this program here, you point to some of the obstacles that are keeping the greater national conversation from moving to answers. How do you see those?
I think there's a number of obstacles. One of the things that we have in this country is we have a very healthy culture of debate. And there is critical importance for debate. But what debate does is it really focuses you on what you disagree on.
Mm-hmm.
And in a debate, the goal is to win. And so you're going to, do your best to sort of find fault with the other person's argument. And our point is that there needs to be a time for dialogue and for people to listen to one another's perspectives and search for common ground. And that's not sort of lowest common denominator consensus. That's the fact that in any of these conversations, and at my organization, we've had conversations on probably, 15 of these gridlock issues, there's much more that people agree on than about which they disagree. And we focus our energies on trying to figure out what people agree on. And what you find in this is that you can't tell who's from a red state, who's from a blue state. You can't. The labels don't apply when people are being asked to think practically about the kinds of choices and trade-offs they would be willing to make.
Once you really get into it with the people, shy of that, you've got, you point out, politicians who don't really want to touch it. The war in Iraq and other issues overshadow it day to day, so they're not incented to get into it. You've got special interest groups, as you say again and again, Heidi, that kind of tie up the conversation and bring
That's
it
right.
that way. But what did you find when these groups of 40 in San Diego, in Kansas City, in Philadelphia, and again, we'll hear from some of the participants, but what kind of consensus were they able to reach? Where did it fall down? Was it hopeful, or did you find polarization there too?
Well, I think for the most part, we found that people across all three had enormous amounts of common ground. And of course, there are differences. And what obviously we would like to do more of these, three of these is really it's a beginning.
Yep,
and
yep.
In order to really say things about what the country thinks, we need to do more. But I mean, I think what Bob said, they're very quick to grasp and to accept that there's a problem and to talk seriously about choices that can be made to do something about it. There was very strong agreement that the national debt is a huge problem and that it is the wrong way to go. And people are very, very concerned that our debt is primarily held by foreign countries and foreign countries that may not be people we want holding that debt, certainly in the future.
Mm-hmm.
People concluded that they were prepared to make sacrifices, to make choices that might not benefit them individually, but would help the country and move it forward.
The same way that a family would around a household budget problem.
Well, that's right. And choices that fit within their value sets, but that made sense for their children and for their grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the way they looked at it. And I think the key thing that we found in all three of these conversations was the issue of trust in government. And this is not terribly surprising. People have really struggled over the past years of what they see as a sort of very dysfunctional political system. They don't believe the system is working. They don't believe their money is being spent wisely. And that was an overarching theme, and that was not, partisan in any way, shape, or form. That was something we heard in all three dialogues. And what blocks people from solutions is not that they're afraid of taxes. They're not afraid of taxes. At least they said they weren't in all three of these conversations, and we've heard that repeatedly. What they're
even Republicans
about,
who are in these groups?
Absolutely. You can ask the participants who are here, but we saw support in all three dialogues for some sort of new tax increase to help fund programs that they thought were essential. The absolute essential condition to that, however, was building trust and accountability and making sure that our money was spent in ways that we thought were appropriate, that the government was a good steward.
And what about the other side of that equation? Were Democratic participants, Democratic Party participants, prepared to see something cut, to give up anything?
Well, it differed in different cities. Again, we don't say, are you a Republican or a Democrat when they come in? And honestly, you can't tell. We do this with congressional fellows in Washington every year, top congressional fellows, half Republican, half Democrat. And when they get talking seriously and practically, you actually can't tell who's a Republican and who's a Democrat. So what we found, we asked all the groups to identify common ground. We know from looking at some of our survey data afterwards that about a quarter of the people identified themselves as highly conservative, about a quarter said they were highly liberal, and the rest said they were moderate, which is basically what you find in America. That's reflective of where the country is. And all three groups said, we are open to new taxes, given that they are spent appropriately, and then talked specifically about what kind of taxes they'd be willing to pay.
I want to turn to three Americans who have participated in some of these conversations already. With us today from San Diego, Audra Cooper. She was in the San Diego Choice Dialogue. She's 26 years old, works as a massage therapist, and was right in the thick of it. Audra Cooper, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
From Kansas City, Elizabeth Watkins is with us. She was in the Kansas City Dialogue, works as a mortgage loan officer there. Elizabeth Watkins, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And also from Kansas City, we're joined by Ralph Wilson. He is a retiree, calls himself a social conservative, was in the thick of the conversation as well. Mr. Wilson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Ralph, let me go to you first, if I may. What did you hear in this conversation? Did you hear fellow citizens coming to consensus, or did you hear the same kind of polarization we hear in the national conversation about the deficit?
There was a pretty general consensus that there needed to be something done to remedy the situation. There wasn't a lot of polarization. I had a lot of ideas. A lot of people were concerned about different things. But in general, everyone was pretty much in agreement that we needed to do something rather quickly and rather radically to fix this problem with our deficit and the out-of-control spending.
Audra Cooper in San Diego, did you come into this conversation thinking this was a critical issue? Did you go out of it thinking that there might be real answers to it that we could agree on?
Absolutely. I mean, it's definitely a critical issue. And it was really surprising to be in such a varied group and have so much common ground about finding a solution, how we're going to do that, and the compromises that we were willing to make across the board.
What kind of compromises did you find yourself sort of opening up to in the process of talking with others who might come from different political starting points?
Well, I come from a pretty liberal background,
okay.
So that's where I was coming from, and it was, again, refreshing to me in a mix of such a mixed group of people, and get good input, and the way people were willing to share their ideas and their ideals, but also say, I will negotiate this. This is negotiable so long as the outcome is of great advantage to everybody. Mm.
Elizabeth Watkins, you're a mortgage loan officer. Maybe not a green eye shade, but you must have been thinking about the bottom line in these conversations. You know, when Americans get together in a kind of citizens gathering, they like to be nice to one another. But did you hear enough compromise, enough flexibility to find agreement on a real solution to this huge problem, Elizabeth?
I heard an incredible amount of flexibility. I would say in the morning, we divided into small groups, and when we came back and reported what our small groups said, I felt more polarization in the morning. By the afternoon, as we went back to our small groups and got into things in more depth and came back afterward, there was so much more consensus. It was very heartening.
And did it get down and dirty? Did it get down to what will we cut? What taxes might we raise? And were people prepared, Elizabeth, to move on those fronts, the real, you know, bottom lines?
I was amazed we had total consensus on being willing to raise some taxes if we knew the money was being spent wisely. And we all felt that citizen watchdog groups should be developed to monitor how the way that our budget is being spent.
Ralph, how about it? Did you hear people even Republicans in these groups prepared to say, okay, I'll chip in more on taxes or not?
Yes, I think everybody was consensus that we need to raise taxes in some areas. I think it was agreed, too, also that we need to spend our money more wisely at home and more of it at home rather than trying to spend it all over the world and promote peace, which doesn't seem to be working too well. But spend more money at home. Take care of the people here at home first.
Keep it home. We're going to see if the kind of consensus emerging here might actually move toward a solution. I want to get our listeners involved in this as well. Linda's calling from Iowa City. Hi, Linda. What are you hearing? What's your answer?
Well, I would say that what we need to do is raise taxes on the top, say, 1.5% to 2%, because they can afford it, on gas and tobacco, because their use costs the country money. And we need to spend the money on education and health care, because they are the necessary foundations for economic growth. And we need to spend it on the poor, because that's necessary for social stability.
And is there something you're willing to give up? The hole is mighty deep. Is there some government program you're willing to see go by the by?
You know, I'm not sure we would have to do that, because when we eliminated the deficit in the 90s, that's pretty much the formula that was followed then. Taxes were raised on the wealthiest 1.5%. Money was kept for education. There was an attempt for health care and programs that helped the poor, particularly things like the earned income tax credit for the working poor, were raised.
Okay, let us look at that. Elizabeth Watkins, what's your sense from your group's conversation? Can we have it all if we reapportion and raise taxes a little? Raise taxes on the most wealthy, we're hearing. Raise taxes on gas and cigarettes. Then invest in education. Don't cut programs. Was your sense that that will mop up the red ink?
We were even willing to raise taxes on our own incomes. And another thing that we all agreed upon was that we wanted the FICA cap gone. Most people did not know this, but if you earn over $90,000 a year, you don't have to pay into the Social Security program anymore after that first $90,000.
Mm-hmm.
Being a straight commission mortgage loan officer, I've earned over that and under that, and I know how that affects me in different ways. But everybody agreed unanimously that we should get rid of the FICA cap and that everybody should be paying into Social Security on every dollar they earn, but there would be a cap on the benefits.
So that's a kind of tax on wealthier Americans who would keep paying where they don't now.
Correct.
Ralph Wilson, was your sense that some programs or some big programs, Social Security, Medicare, have to go by the boards or be radically changed or bumping up taxes enough?
I feel like that Social Security and Medicare, if the money was used where it should be used and spent in a way wisely, that we wouldn't have to go way overboard as far as increasing Social Security taxes. The problem I find and I've found for years is that if the rest of the government agencies would give the money back that they have taken out of the Social Security fund to fund other programs, Social Security wouldn't have a problem.
Of course, that money's gone. It's spent.
That's true, but there should be an IOU or some accounting somewhere. Some of that money should come back to us.
Let me take a call from Mary in Concord, Massachusetts. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I find this really refreshing, and I'm glad you're doing this. I think it's an issue that I'm surprised that hasn't outraged a lot of people, and I hope that through your efforts we can get it more in the mainstream. I think the way taxes, the problem with the Democrats is they come across as being entitlements, that everybody seems to be entitled to things, and where the Republicans seem to think of people needing to have more responsibility. And my friends, I'm independent, but I lean towards the Democrats.
Okay.
But my Republican friends, the issue they have with taxes is they feel that the money is wasted and people feel entitled to it. And I think if there were a message that I think most people could buy into, first of all, that taxes are used as an investment. Taxes are not used to keep people, keep generations of people on a welfare system, keep educational practices, the same ones over and over that aren't producing results. We continue to put money into it. We continue to put money into health care when people don't take personal responsibility for their own health care. But we somehow use it as investments to make sure that whatever investments we make now in health care, in education, in other government programs that one or two generations down the road now, we're not going to have to be putting that kind of money into those, into tax money into those programs.
But what about things that aren't investments but are pretty direct supports, like Social Security? A lot of the elderly depend on that. Medicare, a lot of elderly depend on that, and those are huge expenditures. Are you saying, older man, older woman, you're on your own?
No, I do think that because they have been led to believe, I think incorrectly, that Social Security is going to take care of them, that that is what they're depending on right now, and that's what we need. But I do think that I'm in my 50s, mm-hmm. that I accept the fact, and I think people who are starting out today, my son who's starting out today, they're accepting the fact, and they're accepting personal responsibility more for their retirement. Their retirement is not going to come entirely from the government.
So there's a touch of the George Bush message right there. Mary, thank you for your call. Audra Cooper in San Diego, how about it? Did you hear your fellow Americans in this conversation saying, you know, yes, I'm going to have to back away from the full expectation of the kind of support that we've had historically and be more responsible for myself or not?
I think it was a mix. We do want to follow through with what we feel are the obligations we have to people who are, you know, have the expectation of that money paying for their lifestyles, you know, and that they need medical care and there's a very real necessity and we want to follow through with those obligations. But that for future generations, and I know for myself in my 20s, like I don't have a lot of confidence in that being there for myself and I'm making other plans. Mm-hmm. You know, and trying to take care of myself. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I think everybody felt was that the resources are there, that they're being misappropriated.
Let me pick that up. Robert Bixby, if I may turn to you, your group is all about trying to work out this deficit problem. I'm sure you followed the conversations in these meetings. Did it add up? Does it add up to a bottom line, or was it a feel-good exercise? Are the resources really there? Can we have this without deeper cuts than these groups were prepared to consider in programs currently underway or without higher taxes than they were able to consider? Did you see, you know, a real solution emerging from the kind of consensus that was coming out?
I think that there were some viable solutions that came out of it because, like I said, we don't sit there with a calculator necessarily, but just in general terms, to try to think about whether people are willing to make the serious trade-offs. If you look out into the future, we're going to either have to cut projected spending a whole lot or raise taxes a whole lot because we just got this stream of promises. So what you need to do is see whether people are willing to make some trade-offs there. And by and large, people do seem willing to do that. Now, it's understandable that some of the initial options might not get you all the way. For example, you know, rolling back the tax cuts on the, you know, for millionaires or for the top 1% or something like that.
The Bush era tax cuts here, yeah.
Right. I mean, that helps a bit, but it's not anywhere near what enough to deal with the magnitude of the problem we're facing, or you know, raising tobacco taxes or alcohol taxes.
So you're saying the middle of the population would have to bear a greater burden as well. Did you hear that emerging in this conversation, Robert?
Yeah, I mean, there were people, I think it was one of the participants said, I think people were willing to take on more of the tax burden provided that they thought the money was being well spent. But the real key is that if you want to do it all on the tax side, you'd have to just about double tax rates.
Wow.
You know, and nobody wants to do that. So, I mean, you really, at some point, you've got to get around to looking at the primarily health care entitlements is what drives the unsustainable nature.
Are you talking Medicare there?
Medicare, basically Medicaid to some extent, but Medicare is the real burden. Of course, it's when I say burden, obviously I'm talking about fiscal. It's obviously a fine program, but
but it costs a lot of money. Heidi Gantworth,
it's a good program, but it costs a lot of money. The real key point here is that it's not today's budget that's the problem. It's what is going to happen to the budget when the boomers begin to collect, and if Medicare and healthcare spending in general in the economy continues to grow at the historic rates that it has.
No, we get that 76 million boomers are going to be a heck of a hit. Heidi Gantworth, take us into some of the consensus forming that you saw in these groups. What about Medicare? Were people prepared to change it in some way?
They were. There was a lot of talk about Medicare and how we were prepared to change it. One of the things that people talked a lot about is, you know, how old is old and old is changing. And they also talked about the notion of heroic care. And
that
the
is sort of end
model.
Of life, extreme
That's
measures
right.
to keep people alive, what they're willing to let those go?
Bigger than that, not just end of life, but really, evolved into a conversation of sorts about rationing of care. I mean, what is appropriate care? You know, if somebody is 75 years old and has an expectation that they might live, somewhat longer, they're not, you know, on death's door, is it reasonable to give them very, very expensive medical treatments that may give them an extra 3 or 4 years?
And your groups were saying maybe we'll let go of that.
People were looking at a model that the VA uses, which was much more of a palliative care, geriatric care model. Also looking at drug purchasing, the way that the VA does drug purchasing. It's a single purchaser for prescription drugs. Prescription drugs across the board were something that people were very, very frustrated with. They felt, that Medicare Part D was incredibly problematic, that we needed to look at new ways of doing that.
In fact, to spend less, or do people want to hang on to that prescription subsidy in effect?
Well, they want it to be better run. They think that the big pharmaceuticals have way too much sway over how this is done and would like to see a single purchaser, they think, for Medicare that would work better. In fact, there was quite a lot of talk about investigating a national health care system, which surprised us because that was not on the table.
What about on the defense side? We spend a lot on defense. Do people want to cut that, keep it up? What was the general consensus?
I would say the general consensus was that they didn't think we were going to balance the budget on defense. So we weren't going to cut enough out of defense that was going to be it. They were more open to sort of cuts in other federal activities and serious reform to Social Security and Medicare. What they did say about defense was they felt there was tremendous evidence in defense that we had been wasteful, that we had not been thoughtful in how we'd picked our battles, so to speak, that we need to spend smarter, we need to get rid of no-bid contracts, we need to reallocate and stop fighting the last war. You know, I think a lot of people felt we're still fighting the Cold War. We need to really rethink. We need to retool, focus more on intelligence gathering capabilities, and be far more transparent and efficient in how we're spending our defense dollars.
Terry's calling from near Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Terry. You're on the air.
Thank you. My point is simply this. We have to first determine our priorities as a people and then determine what it is we have to spend, and only spend what we have, and just as most Americans have to do every day in their daily lives.
That sounds very reasonable. Then what do you do about taxes? Of course, that's part of determining what we have, I guess.
Well, I think there are ways that we can maximize the taxes that we're not collecting by changing the way we do tax. I think there are a lot of companies that go offshore to avoid taxes would come back if we looked at restructuring our tax program.
Right. So think about what we really need and then tighten up the tax system and see if there's a way to maximize as it is. Let me get a call from Sutton, Massachusetts. Alex, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I have just a few points to make. First of all, people who think that it is possible to cover the hole by taxing riches 2% don't know arithmetic. So we need like about taxation of confiscatory levels for everybody making over $50,000 for a family to close the hole.
So are taxes the answer or not, Alex?
No, because it will just tank the economy, and it will be not enough.
So what's the way out?
Way out to cut spending, so means tested Social Security. So we don't have to pay benefits for middle class, government benefit, like everywhere upper middle class is having benefits from the government, be it Social Security, Medicare.
So some means testing on those huge entitlement programs. We get it. Alex, thank you for your call. Lena's calling from Plainville, Connecticut. Hi, Lena. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I actually agree with Linda's statements that she made when she called at first. And I think that what I'd like to add to her comments is that, you know, we have a huge population of the elderly, and it's going to continue growing because we have better health care.
Yeah.
So we need to take that into account when we're spending. And if we think about the U.S. budget as we would a family budget, then, you know, we prioritize, and health is certainly up there.
So are you willing to, we heard that these groups were saying maybe we won't have that heroic care if you're 75 plus, you know, maybe not quite so much spent on saving your life. How about that?
Well, and, you know, that's a huge philosophical question that, you know, I think I would need more time to think on. But, you know, if you look at the amount of people that are having cosmetic surgery, liposuction, and, you know, all that money, there's that very small percentage of extremely wealthy people. And I think tapping into and really making the taxation more equitable is the solution, which would probably mean that I would need to pay a little more in taxes. But if that means that, you know, my children will have proper health care, if that means that the education system will be subsidized so that any student, no matter what, how much money the family has.
Yeah, so you pay a little more, but then, of course, it gets tough if it's going to require a lot more. Lena, thank you very much for your call. Let me get one more here from Savannah, Georgia. Charles is on the line. Hi, Charles. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I guess I come from a libertarian perspective, and from the way I see things, the federal government just is spending so much of the money that they get in completely the wrong area or areas.
Like what?
I guess in terms of, let's take defense as one item. We got people in Congress who are just absolutely committed to spending more and more money in their own, in the plants, in the defense plants in their own districts. And
do you think we can fix the problem by tightening up? Let's say everybody says we don't want, you know, bad spending, but is tightening up on waste and pork enough, Charles, or do you expect it's going to have to hit home more than that?
I think it's going to have to be a whole lot more than that, Tom. I think this is a great debate that we're having here, I think the problem is that what we're talking about is really somewhat hypothetical. As long as the voters keep returning the self-serving incumbents to Congress, I just don't see anything happening, unfortunately. And I think we're leaving a legacy that is absolutely appalling for our kids.
Charles, we've got it. Ralph Wilson in Kansas City. How about that? Of course, you know, this all gets processed through our representative democracy, as our Constitution requires. What was your group's sense about whether the kind of compromises and consensus you were able to reach would actually play out through your congressmen?
Well, I have been an advocate for several years of the gentleman just ahead of me said something about the inherent congressmen and senators over and over again sending it back to Congress. I would like to see them be limited to two terms in the Congress and out, like we have for other things. That might alleviate some of the pork in various areas that as an independent spending and other areas that take a lot of the money that, to me, is partially wasted.
And Audra Cooper in San Diego, what was the sense of your group? Did you come out feeling sort of united, we can do this, if only our congressman would get together the way we have?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, too, that we weren't polarized, which is something that seems to happen in the debate in Washington. And on an individual level with a group of citizens, that was totally irrelevant. We all wanted the same things. You know, we were all willing to sacrifice something that was important to us to achieve those goals. And that doesn't happen in Washington. But a group of citizens in San Diego isn't being lobbied by billion-dollar corporations and industries. There isn't that division between achieving a goal for somebody else and doing what we feel is right for everybody.
Robert Bixby, give us a reality check here. The word we're hearing is we were all prepared to sacrifice, but there's a lot that people clearly want to hold on to as well. If these groups understood the depth of sacrifice necessary to fix these problems, do you think a consensus would hold, or does it break up there when you really get real about what it will take?
Well, I think that it would certainly test the consensus, but I think what you'd have is a more realistic debate. It is key for people to understand the depth of the long-term problem and how truly unsustainable it is, which is why you can get groups with diverse views like Heritage and Brookings and Concord all saying the same thing, that we need to make these choices. You know, once you some of the ideas that, come up, like waste, fraud, and abuse, as people have mentioned, you do have to deal with it because it's on people's minds. But people also have to understand that, there's just not enough waste, fraud, and abuse in the federal government to take care of the depth of the long-term problems that we have. And people are willing to raise taxes, you know, primarily on, the wealthy. There's a tendency to say, let's raise taxes on, you know,
the rich.
Well, yeah, the rich or somebody else. And that's not enough either. But again, that's a strategy that, you know, can be on the table, should be on the table. I think everything should be on the table. But I think that, you know, really you do have to get into the long-term entitlement problems, which is an unprecedented thing. People are used to looking at the budget deficit as a short-term thing. Sometimes it's caused by a downturn in the economy or a war or something like
that. But this time it's long-term. I want to go to Elizabeth Watkins in Kansas City, if I may.
We've had to deal with.
We're getting that. Elizabeth, again, you're the mortgage loan officer. Was your sense at the end of the day that these Americans across the political lines that you sat down with were prepared to do what it takes, or were they still kind of ducking and bobbing, weaving, dodging the problem?
No, I was really impressed at the point where people agreed that if we could trust our government to spend wisely, we would all be willing to have our taxes raised. It wasn't just focused on the rich or on corporations, which is really a great place to start, but that we're all actually willing to pay for something if we know we're going to get something from it.
If you can just trust it. Heidi Gantworth, where does it go next? Where does this deliberative democracy roll on to?
Well, the idea of these dialogues is to provide a roadmap for leaders, to say that there are doors open that you may not think are open. Taxes is not a third rail. The issue is trust and accountability. You can talk about changes to entitlement programs. These things are possible if you allow different perspectives to come into the conversation. So it helps leaders to lead more effectively with better information than they're getting now from polls and focus groups, which give you a snapshot that don't get you very far.
I want to thank the three participants in these groups for their time in the conversation, their time with us today. Audra Cooper, Elizabeth Watkins, and Ralph Wilson in Kansas City and San Diego. Thank you very much to all three of you for your contributions. And Heidi Gantworth at Viewpoint Learning, Inc. in San Diego. Heidi, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Robert Bixby at the Concord Coalition, Executive Director there. Mr. Bixby, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.